KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Mohsin was an incredible partner in conversation about peacemaking and bridge building in a reality that is extremely polarized. He was doing the really hard work of empathy, listening to people, trying to bring people together across enormous divide.
Calls are mounting for the release of Columbia University student Mohsen Makhdawi, who is set to graduate this spring, but was detained by Homeland Security agents in Vermont when he went for his naturalization test. We'll speak with Democratic Congress member Becca Vallant, the first Jewish member of Congress to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. She's from Vermont. Then Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp. All three are owned by Meta. This week, in a major trial, the Federal Trade Commission's arguing Meta has an illegal monopoly and should be forced to break up. We'll speak with former Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen. Then Harvard University's pushing back as President Trump ramps up his attacks on higher education.
When it comes to Harvard, as I said, the president has been quite clear they must follow federal law. He also wants to see Harvard apologize, and Harvard should apologize for the egregious anti-Semitism that took place on their college campus against Jewish American students. As for the tax-exempt status, I would defer you to the IRS for any updates.
We'll speak to Professor Andrew Crespo at Harvard Law School. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge is weighing contempt proceedings against Trump administration officials over the case of Maryland father Kilmer Abrego Garcia, who was wrongfully sent to a maximum security mega prison in El Salvador in March. Judge Paula Zinnes on Tuesday questioned why Garcia was still, quote, inexplicably detained in El Salvador's notorious terrorism confinement center, or SECAT, despite rulings, including by the U.S. Supreme Court, ordering his return. Judge Zinnes also said there's no evidence so far that shows Trump officials have even attempted to facilitate Garcia's safe return home, and gave them until next week to turn over documents and sit for depositions to explain steps they've taken to secure Abrego Garcia's return. Protesters gathered outside the courthouse in Greenbelt, Maryland, Tuesday. This is Abrego Garcia's wife, Jennifer.
Today is 34 days of after his disappearance, and I stand before you filled with spirit that refuses to bring down. I will not stop fighting until I see my husband alive.
Jennifer is an American citizen. They have a five-year-old child. Democratic Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen is traveling to El Salvador today to push for Abrego Garcia's release from prison. Demands are mounting for other Democratic lawmakers to join. Meanwhile, as the Trump administration continues to defend its decision refusing to bring Abrego Garcia home, reports emerge the police officer who formerly accused Abrego Garcia without evidence of being a member of MS-13 was later suspended for misconduct. Those revelations didn't stop White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt from making these comments Tuesday.
There is never going to be a world in which this is an individual who's going to live a peaceful life in Maryland, because he is a foreign terrorist and a MS-13 gang member.
Kilmer Abrego Garcia lived in Maryland for almost 15 years after fleeing gang violence in El Salvador. He was a sheet metal apprentice. The president of North America's building trades unions, Sean McGarvey, received a standing ovation from a crowd of workers when he recently demanded Garcia's return.
We need to make our voices heard. We're not red, we're not blue. We're the building trades, the backbone of America. We built a $5 billion, you want to build a $5 billion data center? Want more six-figure careers with healthcare, retirement, and no college debt? You don't call Elon Musk. You call us. Yeah. North America's building trade unions. And yeah, that means all of us. All of us, including our brother, Smart Apprentice, Kilmar Arbrega Garcia, who we demand to be returned to us and his family now. Bring him home.
He received a standing ovation from the workers. A federal judge in Massachusetts has ruled against the Trump administration, temporarily blocking its attempt to revoke deportation, protection, and work permits for an estimated 500,000 people from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela living in the U.S. under humanitarian parole program. Gerline Joseph, executive director of the Haitian Bridge Alliance, said in a statement, quote, hundreds of thousands of our neighbors will go to sleep tonight knowing that the Trump administration's attempts to delegitimize and criminalize our communities have been thwarted for now. This win is a testament to the power and dedication of our communities, unquote. This comes as several immigration attorneys have received letters from Customs and Border Protection in recent days ordering them to self-deport, even though the lawyers are U.S. citizens. That includes at least one immigration lawyer in Ohio and two in Massachusetts who received an email reading, quote, DHS is terminating your parole. Do not attempt to remain in the United States. The federal government will find you, unquote. A New Hampshire newly released video shows the moment federal immigration agents tackled a Venezuelan man inside a Nashua courthouse as he prepared for his arraignment on misdemeanor charges. The video shows he was violently pressed to the ground by the agents, who also knocked over and injured an elderly bystander. Meanwhile, a real estate attorney from New Hampshire was stopped by U.S. Customs and Border Protection on Sunday as he crossed into Vermont following a weekend visit to Canada. Achir Atala is a Lebanese-American, a U.S. citizen. He says he was treated like a criminal and detained without explanation by agents who twisted his arm and handcuffed him, prompting a medical emergency as his blood pressure spiked. Atala described the incident to NBC 10 Boston.
He asked me, exit the vehicle right now, and he reached for his gun. I said, okay, I'm exiting the vehicle. Keep your gun at your waist. So I had to, under duress, give him permission to look through my email, through my privileged information, and he made me write a statement signed by me saying that I gave him permission to look through the email.
In Georgia, a man was tased by police on Tuesday as protesters peacefully disrupted a town hall in Cobb County hosted by Republican Congress member, the far-right Marjorie Taylor Greene. Video shows several police officers escorting the man out of the venue when one of the officers fired the taser. Shortly after the protester was tased, Greene said to the crowd, quote, this is a peaceful town hall. At a separate Republican town hall in Iowa Tuesday, a crowd heckled and grilled 91-year-old Senator Chuck Grassley on the Trump administration's mass deportation scheme.
The Constitution, the framers of the Constitution, said that every person, right, not citizen, right, every person within the jurisdiction of the United States has due process. And we would like to know what you, as the people, the Congress, who are supposed to rein in this dictator, what are you going to do about it? These people have been sentenced to life imprisonment in a foreign country with no due process.
Republican lawmakers who are back in their districts during a two-week congressional recess have largely opted out of town halls or shifted to virtual town halls to avoid protest. Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz says his forces will continue their siege of the Gaza Strip, where over 2 million people have gone more than 6 weeks with no shipments of food, water, medicine, and other life-saving supplies. Katz also said Israel will continue occupying parts of Gaza indefinitely, calling them security zones, and pledged Israeli forces will remain in occupied parts of Lebanon and Syria as well. Al Jazeera reports at least 19 people have been killed in Israeli attacks across Gaza since dawn today, including 10 people killed in a strike on eastern Gaza City. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports autopsies of the 15 paramedics and rescue workers killed in an Israeli shooting last month died mainly from gunshots to the head or chest. Their bodies were discovered in a mass grave with the crushed remains of ambulances, a fire truck, and a UN vehicle buried nearby. President Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff said Tuesday Iran must completely end its nuclear enrichment program as part of any nuclear deal with the Trump administration. It's a reversal of a policy Witkoff spelled out on Fox News just a day prior when he said Iran should be allowed to conduct verified low-level enrichment of uranium for civilian use. Witkoff's apparent U-turn followed a successful opening round of indirect talks in Oman with Iran, with more negotiations scheduled for this weekend. In Tehran, Iran's foreign ministry said the U.S. must take concrete and effective steps to lift sanctions that have devastated Iran's economy.
Iran's main negotiation topic and primary demand is the removal of the unjust and illegal sanctions imposed on the Iranian people for decades. This is a serious and fundamental request, and we made this clear in the negotiations in Muscat.
The White House has further escalated its trade war with China, threatening to impose a tariff of up to 245% on most imports of Chinese goods to the United States. The threat, in a fact sheet published by the White House late Tuesday, prompted China's foreign ministry to call for a de-escalation.
This tariff war was initiated by the U.S. side, and China took necessary countermeasures to safeguard its legitimate rights and interests, as well as international fairness and justice, which are completely reasonable and lawful. China's position has always been clear. There is no winner in a tariff or a trade war.
NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte pledged unwavering support for Ukraine Tuesday as he visited the southern Ukrainian city of Odessa for talks with President Volodymyr Zelensky. Their meeting came a day after President Trump once again blamed Ukraine, not Russia, for starting the war.
When you start a war, you got to know that you can win the war, right? You don't start a war against somebody that's 20 times your size and then hope that people give you some missiles.
Trump made those remarks after downplaying a Russian attack on the city of Sumy on Sunday that killed 35 people and injured more than 100 others in one of the deadliest attacks on civilians since Russia's 2022 full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The White House is issuing new media restrictions that will significantly curtail access to President Trump by media wire services, including the Associated Press and Reuters. This comes after a federal judge ruled the Trump administration had violated the AP's free speech rights when it banned reporters from the White House after the news agency refused to adopt Trump's new name for the Gulf of Mexico. A Russian court in Moscow has sentenced four journalists to 5.5 years in prison each after convicting them of extremism. Two of the four worked for Sotavision, which documents Russian protests and court proceedings. The others contributed to international news outlets, including Reuters and the Associated Press. Prosecutors allege that the journalists were involved with a banned anti-corruption organization founded by Alexei Navalny, the opposition politician who died in a Russian penal colony last year following repeated assassination attempts. Lawmakers in Hungary have approved a constitutional amendment banning public events by the LGBTQ plus community, including pride celebrations. The amendment also enshrines the principle that Hungary only recognizes two genders, male and female, in line with the Prime Minister Viktor Orban's far-right agenda. In London, the United Kingdom's Supreme Court has ruled unanimously that the definition of a woman does not include trans women, who will no longer be protected as women under Britain's Equality Act. The case was brought by the group For Women Scotland, which is partly funded by the writer J.K. Rowling, author of the Harry Potter franchise. The International Maritime Organization has reached a deal to curb greenhouse gas emissions from the global shipping industry. The agreement will penalize ships that fall short of targets for reducing carbon dioxide pollution. The agreement was approved at a conference in London after the Trump administration withdrew the U.S. from the talks, urging other countries to follow suit and threatening reciprocal measures against any fees charged to U.S. vessels. And in Brazil, climate activists rallied in the capital, Brasilia, Tuesday, demanding urgent action to protect the Amazon and indigenous communities ahead of the United Nations COP30 climate summit set to take place in the northeastern city of Belém in November. This is indigenous leader Marcia Litupari.
One of the issues we will bring to COP30 is the importance of demarcating indigenous lands and recognizing indigenous territories as a climate issue. Because we know, for example, that in Brazil, we still have protected areas with living forests, thanks to indigenous territories. So we want this to be discussed in these spaces, for indigenous leadership to be present in them, and for our national representatives to hear our voices.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Vermont, where the Trump administration is seeking to deport Columbia University student Mohsen Mahdawi because his activities could, quote, potentially undermine, unquote, the Middle East peace process. That's the reason cited by Secretary of State Marco Rubio in a memo the Department of Homeland Security submitted in Mahdawi's case, the same one cited for the detention of his fellow Columbia student protest leader, Mahmoud Khalil. Mohsen Mahdawi was set to graduate Columbia this spring, but he's now being held in a prison in northwest Vermont after he was detained by Homeland Security agents when he went to an immigration services center to take a civics test that's the final step in the process of becoming a naturalized U.S. citizen. Mahdawi has been a permanent resident, a green card holder, since 2015, for a decade. He moved to Vermont from the occupied West Bank in 2014, where he was the third generation in his family to live in Fraa, a Palestinian refugee camp. He then attended Lehigh University in Pennsylvania before transferring to Columbia in 2021 to study international affairs. His legal team says they have not received, quote, any information or basis for his detention. They say the militant Zionist organization Batar has called for his deportation and targeted him online. The group wrote online Monday, quote, we confirm we provided info on him and many others, unquote. This comes as all three members of Vermont's congressional delegation, Senators Bernie Sanders and Peter Welch, as well as the Congress member, Becca Ballant, are calling for Mahdawi's release, as well as Vermont's Republican Governor Phil Scott, who issued a statement Tuesday criticizing his detention. In a minute, we'll speak with Democratic Congressmember Ballant of Vermont. But first, Democracy Now! Spoke Tuesday to one of the many people who knows Mahdawi well and have been speaking out since he was taken by federal immigration agents.
My name is Gilly Getz. I'm an organizer. I'm Israeli. I'm a peace activist, and I'm an organizer with the Israelis for Peace. It's a group we started after October 7. We looked for a place where we could be fully human and recognize the humanity of Israelis and Palestinians and everybody who lives in the land. And Mohsen was an incredible partner in conversation about peacemaking and bridge building in a reality that is extremely polarized. He was doing the really hard work of empathy, listening to people, trying to bring people together across enormous divide. And the news of his kidnapping by the Trump administration was so devastating to us, as is the news of kidnapping of all students illegally, unlawfully, as part of a larger attack on our democracy, our freedom, just our ability to live in a democracy.
That was Gilly Getz, an organizer with the group Israelis for Peace NYC, who knows Mohsen Mahdawi. For more, we go to Brattleboro, Vermont, where we're joined by Democratic Congressmember Becca Ballant. She's the first Jewish member of Congress to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. She is the granddaughter of a man who is lost in the Holocaust. She issued a statement this week with Vermont Senators Bernie Sanders and Peter Welch on the Trump administration's detention of Mohsen, saying, quote, this is immoral, inhumane, and illegal. Mr. Mahdawi, a legal resident of the United States, must be afforded due process under the law and immediate release from detention. Congressmember Ballant, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Talk about what's taken place. I mean, the fact that he was brought to Vermont, and explain, he reached out to all three of you to Senators Welch and Sanders and you before saying, I'm being told to come in for this test. I'm worried this is a trap.
Yeah, and so, you know, what I want people to understand is you have a situation, as you said, he has been a green card holder for 10 years. Mr. Makhdaoui has been accused of no crime. Okay, this is critically important for people to understand. He's been accused of no crime, went in for his final citizenship interview. It seems like this was possibly a ruse to get him to show up, then arrested upon his arrival. And again, I want people to understand these were masked, hooded men in plain clothes with an unmarked van handcuffing him. This is not the America I think many of us thought we lived in. And he was not afforded the ability to speak to his attorney right away. He was not afforded due process in a court of law. He's being attacked because of free speech. This should terrify every single person living in this country, regardless of your citizenship status. They are coming for people because of their beliefs and what they may have said. And, you know, I'm so enraged by this also because of who Mr. Makhdaoui is. He has said in the past that the fight for freedom of Palestine and the fight against anti-Semitism go hand in hand because injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. He is not someone who is a threat to our supposed international foreign policy interests. And it's critically important that we do not allow Secretary Rubio to make these claims without providing proof, evidence to Congress. He is required to provide certification of his personal determination about Makhdaoui's threat to our country to Congress. That has not happened. And it is clear that he is abusing his position as Secretary of State, and I won't have it.
Representative, you're a vice-ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee. Have you had any conversations with your fellow members of the committee, especially some Republicans, about this state of affairs of federal officers, as you say, mass grabbing people off the street and disappearing them effectively?
You would think that Republicans who serve on the Judiciary Committee would care deeply about the rule of law, care deeply about the Constitution. When we brought up the case of Abrego Garcia that you were just discussing on the show, who is a constituent of our ranking member, Jamie Raskin, in the committee, we were mocked. We were dismissed, saying that they were spewing all kinds of lies about him. And they do not seem to understand that their stance on this is a threat to Americans everywhere. They are using talking points from this administration that are based in lies, and they don't seem to care the damage that they are doing, certainly to these individual men and women who are being detained and disappeared, but more broadly to our Constitution and the system of government that we have here. It is shocking, it's disheartening, and you can bet that we're going to continue to bring up these issues within the committee. But it is a bleak time right now in the Judiciary Committee where we can't even get our colleagues to stand up for our Constitution, something we thought we all agreed upon.
Could you talk as well about the difference with the public officials in Vermont? There was recently a Russian scientist working at Harvard, Ksenia Petrova, was detained by ICE and held at a Vermont women's prison in South Burlington for a week. How have officials in Vermont responded to these things?
So I will tell you that it's clear to me that we need a much stronger pushback from all elected officials in Vermont. I want more transparency about the kind of agreements that the state of Vermont has entered into with the federal government on these cases. Many of us in Vermont, and I was at a town hall the other night that was packed, many people asking about how is it that in a state that believes so clearly, the name, you know, the motto of our state is freedom and unity, We stand up for each other. We believe in the rule of law. We believe in freedom. That we need more full-throated statements from elected officials, from the governor on down, about asking for more transparency on these issues. Vermonters do not want this happening in their name. And you can bet that the senators and I are going to continue to demand more answers. This is not who we are as Vermonters. It's not who we are as Americans.
Congressmember Becca Vallant, I wanted to ask you about Remesa Ozturk, the graduate student at Tufts, who was taken off the street as she was going to dinner by masked agents. She even said to them, I'm calling the police. They said, we are the police. Also, interestingly, one of her lawyers said at a Liberation Seder outside of ICE headquarters in New York the other day that she had told him that when the ICE agents surrounded her, they said, we are not monsters, one of them said. We are not monsters. We are only following orders. Now, she, too, was driven to Vermont and then flown away. Can you explain, since now the federal court in Vermont is taking on her case, what's happening with Remesa?
Yes. And so it is deeply disturbing that she was so quickly flown away from our state. It's difficult to obviously to have oversight when without any delay in her movement, we were not able to get the answers that we need. There's a lot we don't know about her case, so I don't want to misspeak. What I do know is that any person who is in this situation needs to be absolutely clear that they have right to due process. This is the piece that's getting lost here. This is a thing that my Republican colleagues will say. I had a colleague who used to be on the Judiciary Committee with me. Her name is Representative Victoria Spartz. She said in a town hall a few weeks ago, you know, that these folks who are here legally, if they're not residents, aren't entitled to due process. It's absolutely not true. Anyone within the borders of the United States are entitled to due process. And so it is critically important that we as Americans, regardless of party, stand up for all of these students who are being detained, all of these professors and people who are simply speaking their minds who are being detained, that this is not in accordance with what our government stands for. And it is chilling to the bone to have somebody say, we are just following orders. That is what they said in Nazi Germany. That is what people said when they were listening to the Gestapo. This has got to stop. This is Trump creating his own army of brown shirts right here in our country.
And Congresswoman, I wanted to ask you about if you could comment on the irony that here we've seen repeatedly now of federal agents, as you say, masked when they are apprehending and detaining people, at the same time that the Trump administration is demanding that universities ban masks in any protests held on university campuses.
Yes, that gives up the game right there. Okay. This entire fury that the Trump administration has directed at institutions of higher ed, it's not about anti-Semitism. It's not. And I will not continue to have this, these outrageous statements being made in my name and others who have been actually impacted by anti-Semitism. This is about authoritarianism. This is about attacking institutions, including schools, so that everyone will bend a knee and will cower in the face of an autocrat. This is what that's about. And the fact that they are so intellectually inconsistent, even about something like masks, gives up the game right there. They don't care about anti-Semitism. They are using this as a tool, a battering ram against our institutions. And I hope that so many Americans who are of Jewish descent will stand up with me and say, not in our name. Absolutely not.
And finally, Congressmember Becca Ballant, you're a graduate of the Harvard School of Education. Before you were a state legislator and a Congress member, you were a middle school teacher. Your thoughts on Harvard standing up? We'll be speaking with a Harvard law professor at the end of the broadcast, but rejecting the Trump administration's attack on them. And now President Trump is threatening to pull their nonprofit status.
I am thrilled that Harvard is taking a stance, and I am frustrated that other institutions of higher learning are not taking this stance. I hope they will get some courage and some backbone from what Harvard has done. Here's the message. Whether you are an institution of higher ed, or you are a law firm, or you are an organization, or you're a business, we have got to stand together. They are going to continue to pick us off one by one. And our strength comes in our unity. And I'm angry that it took Harvard standing up for some other colleges and universities to say, oh, maybe that actually is the right path. I'm very disturbed by how easily people have decided to take a knee in front of this autocrat. And we have to stand together, folks. We have to stand together.
You lost your grandfather in the Holocaust?
I did. And I have often asked myself throughout my adulthood, what would I do in the face of such depravity? And the answer is, you don't lose your voice. You stand up. And he lost his life in the last few weeks of the war, standing up for another who was imprisoned. They were on a forced march out of Mauthausen concentration camp. And one of his fellow prisoners fell behind, and he stayed back to help him, and they were both executed. And that has ridden me my whole life. You do the right thing, even in the midst of depravity, even when there is danger. You have to have skin in the game. And that's my message to all Americans. We all have to stand up for each other.
Democratic Congressmember Becca Ballant of Vermont, first Jewish member of Congress to call for a ceasefire in Gaza, the daughter of an immigrant and the granddaughter of her grandfather who died in the Holocaust. When we come back, Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, what do they have in common? Meta. Could it be broken up by the Federal Trade Commission? Stay with us.
يوم عم بنزيد شوف فايدة الكترة والحرية مش بالإيد من يوم ما وعيت وأنا بنت هاي البلاد بكاء أطفال وبسمة أولاد الأرض صوبها أسود خيم علينا حداد بطلنا نعد أحياء صرنا نعد أموات وأنا بقول بكفي عاد بدي أمسك قدري بكفي بكفي عاد فهمي ومش فهمي عايشي ومش عايشي البحر ميت أنا وحدي طايشي مهتمي ومش مهتمي عارفي ومش عارفي
Enough by Mesa Dahl. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp. What do all these three widely used social media platforms have in common? They're all owned by Meta. This week, a highly anticipated antitrust trial kicked off in Washington, D.C., in which the Federal Trade Commission's arguing Meta has an illegal monopoly that should be forced to divest Instagram and WhatsApp. If Meta loses a trial, it could be forced to sell off those platforms. Mark Zuckerberg took the stand Monday and said, quote, I think we misunderstood how social engagement online was evolving, he said. Former FTC Chair Lina Khan spoke to CNN Monday about the case.
One interesting set of evidence that the FTC has is that Facebook has actually made its services worse for its users. And so they note, for example, that Facebook has been significantly increasing the number of ads that it pushes to users, even though that makes the service worse. And that has not led it to suffer consequences in the marketplace, which itself is a marker of its monopoly power.
For more, we're joined by Frances Haugen, who is herself a former Facebook whistleblower, an advocate for social media transparency and accountability. Her memoir is titled The Power of One: How I Found the Strength to Tell the Truth and Why I Blew the Whistle on Facebook. Frances Haugen, welcome to Democracy Now! This is extremely significant. You certainly started the ball rolling in an enormous way when you testified before Congress. Talk about what's at stake here and what you understood early on, even working at Facebook, that led you to be a whistleblower.
We have let a single company controlled by a single person, remember Mark Zuckerberg holds the majority of voting shares for Facebook, so he's really the only voice. We've let one company, one man, influence the information environment for the world. I came forward as a whistleblower because I worked internally on issues around ethnic violence, manipulation of our political environment, information operations, foreign interference. And I saw how unseriously Facebook took these issues, particularly in countries in Africa and Southeast Asia. This case is so important because there are material differences between how different social media platforms treat issues of safety. TikTok, for all the things I'm critical of it, actually does a lot of things around children's safety much better than Instagram. Same with things like Snapchat. Meta, because it is controlling these three critical platforms, because it runs the internet for billions of people, doesn't have to actually deal with having a competitor that might have an awareness of its responsibilities in the world and a commitment to safety.
Why, Frances Haugen, why would it been, should it have been illegal for Facebook to acquire Instagram in 2012 and WhatsApp in 2014?
So I think the question of, the circumstances have changed so much. Like I'm sympathetic to what happened when the FTC originally approved these deals. These were very, very small companies. They were bought not because of their size, but because of their velocity. And I think the FTC didn't realize how much that mattered. So back in 2012, when Instagram was bought, when we look at the FTC's court documents they've already released, the thing that Mark Zuckerberg explicitly is saying to his other executives is, we can see how big this is going to get. They should have not approved it back then because of the dynamics of where the app was going, but they definitely need to break it up today, because it is the dominant form of social media for children, for young adults under the age of, say, 25.
And what was in those emails that Zuckerberg sent in 2008?
So it's wild. There's a long series of, I encourage people, I know it's gonna sound dry, the federal government has released a huge number of documents in this case, and you can go see the exact words of Mark Zuckerberg talking about these companies. We're talking about why Facebook wants to buy them. They say explicitly, we know we're behind. We know we have an inferior photos product. At a minimum, we'll buy ourselves time. If we lock it up, we don't have to worry about Google. We don't have to worry about Apple. We don't have to worry about someone who might go and make a competitor to Facebook coming along. Those emails are more explicit in many, many ways than the antitrust suit against Google, which was lost last year. It's gonna be fascinating to see how this plays out, because it's so clear the intention here was to hurt consumers.
And what did Mark Zuckerberg know, and when did he know it, Frances Haugen? You're famous for, in 2021, turning over tens of thousands of pages of internal Facebook documents to U.S. regulators and the Wall Street Journal, which became the basis of a damning series of reports called the Facebook Papers. Talk about what he said this week in this trial and what it would mean if it was broken apart.
It's fascinating. Mark borrowed a big page from what Google did when they testified also last year, which was, even though he was shown document after document where in his own words, he's saying, we need to buy Instagram to make the product not as good, to make sure we're not threatened. When asked, you know, what does this mean? Why did you write this? Why these things? He said, oh, I have no idea. I don't remember. One of the explicit things the government is calling out and asking the courts to adjudicate is, should the interpretations in the documents contemporaneous to when these decisions were made? Because remember, this is going on for months and months before Instagram was bought back, you know, over 10 years ago. In those emails, they're very explicit about why they did these things. The fact that Mark can get on stage and say, I don't know why I did this, I didn't know why I did that, waffling on what he thinks the implications are of these things. He said as little as he could, given that he had to sit on the stand for 7 hours.
And what would happen if Instagram and WhatsApp are separated from Meta? What would be your sense of the impact on big tech? Because Meta, of course, is not the only company. There are all these miracle seven tech companies that really are dominating the U.S. Markets these days.
So one of the things that I think we should give the Trump administration credit for is that this case is still underway. You know, there's many, many things where we're seeing chaos in the federal government right now. But, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and all the big tech companies have been lobbying the Trump administration incredibly aggressively to drop their cases. You know, if we look at the inauguration, a huge swath of tech, of the biggest tech CEOs were sitting on the dais with Trump. You know, they were paying for the privilege of being able to say, oh, please, please intervene. And yet the FTC continued with this case. And the head commissioner has said repeatedly, you know, we've been working on this for 5 years. We're not going to give up on it. And so I think the thing will be incredibly interesting to see play out over the next year is Google lost the first step of their case. The thing that the courts are now trying to decide is what is an appropriate remedy. Similarly, there's cases out against Amazon. There's cases out against Apple. We need to be having conversations about how much concentration of power we want to have in our economy and the implications of having just a few people be able to influence how we even interpret the world on such a fundamental level.
Frances Haugen, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Frances Haugen, former Facebook whistleblower, an advocate for social media transparency and accountability. Her memoir is titled The Power of One: How I Found the Strength to Tell the Truth and Why I Blew the Whistle on Facebook. She was speaking to us from San Juan, Puerto Rico. When we come back, we go to Harvard Law School to speak with Professor Andrew Manuel Crespo as Harvard pushes back against Trump's attacks on higher education. Stay with us.
There's music and there's laughter. I don't know if I'm scared of dying, but I'm scared of living too fast, too slow. Regret, remorse, hold on. No, no, I gotta go. There's no starting over, no new beginnings. Time raises on. Just gotta keep on keeping on. Gotta keep on going, looking straight out on the road. Can't worry about what's behind you, what's coming for you further up the road. Try not to hold on to what is gone. I try to do right what is wrong. I try to keep on keeping on.
My Silver Lining by First Aid Kit. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show on the campus of Harvard University as the Ivy League institution pushes back against President Trump's attacks on higher education. This week, the Trump administration said it's freezing $2.2 billion in federal grants and $60 million in contracts to Harvard after it defied an order to eliminate all DEI initiatives, further crack down on Palestinian rights protests, including reporting international students to federal authorities, among a number of other issues. Harvard President Alan Garber wrote in a letter to the school community Monday, quote, the university will not surrender its independence or relinquish its constitutional rights. No government, regardless of which party is in power, should dictate what private universities can teach, whom they can admit and hire, and which areas of study and inquiry they can pursue, unquote. On Tuesday, President Trump posted on Truth Social, quote, perhaps Harvard should lose its tax-exempt status and be taxed as a political entity if it keeps pushing political, ideological, and terrorist-inspired supporting sickness. Remember, tax-exempt status is totally contingent on acting in the public interest, exclamation point, the President of the United States tweeted. At a press briefing on Tuesday, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt was asked about Trump's threat to remove Harvard's tax-exempt status. This was her response.
When it comes to Harvard, as I said, the president has been quite clear. They must follow federal law. He also wants to see Harvard apologize, and Harvard should apologize for the egregious anti-Semitism that took place on their college campus against Jewish American students. As for the tax-exempt status, I would defer you to the IRS for any updates.
Also this week, Harvard joined a group of universities that sued the Department of Energy over cuts to federal research funding. For more, we go to Harvard Law School in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where we're joined by Professor Andrew Manuel Crespo, the Morris Wasserstein Public Interest Professor of Law, where he joins us now from. He's the general counsel of the Harvard Faculty Chapter of the American Association of University Professors, which last Friday filed a federal lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the administration's funding cuts and that sought a court order to block them. Last year, Professor Crespo was one of dozens of Harvard University professors who staged a study-in protest at the school's library in solidarity with students disciplined for taking part in a pro-Palestinian demonstration. He was then banned from the Harvard Law Library temporarily. We welcome you, Professor, to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the stance that Harvard has taken, which has surprised many?
Yes, and thank you for having me. It's really wonderful to be with you. I think it was really encouraging and important to see the Harvard administration leadership here send the letter that it did to the Trump administration. You know, our chapter had gone to court, as you mentioned, a few days prior to file a lawsuit to block these cuts from happening because these cuts are unquestionably unconstitutional. Our Constitution has a First Amendment that protects freedom of speech. And as the U.S. Supreme Court has made abundantly clear, academic freedom on university campuses is a central component of that right to free speech. What the Trump administration is trying to do is use massive coercive pressure and threats to make universities across the country switch to talking about what the Trump administration wants them to say. He wants to control what's said in our classrooms, what's said on our campuses, what we research about, what we write about, the questions we ask and the answers we give so that they fit the ideological agenda of the Trump administration. That's dangerous and it's unconstitutional. We went to court to stop it from happening, and I was really glad to see our leadership here at Harvard a few days later follow suit and say that they are not going to accede to these demands.
And Professor Crespo, I want to congratulate the AAUP chapter there for taking this stance, but I'm wondering why didn't it, since it appears to be so clearly illegal to do this, why the university itself hasn't gone to court?
Well, we'll have to see what happens there. You know, the university is taking its own sort of deliberations into account. It has big questions ahead of it. These are hard questions. You know, no university should be in this position. No institution in this country should be in this position. It is dangerous and scary to see the President of the United States threatening law firms, trying to bankrupt them when they dare to go to court and file suits that try to hold our government to account under the laws of this country. It's dangerous and scary and authoritarian to see the President of the United States trying to bankrupt our leading research universities because he wants to control what they're teaching, control what they're saying in the classroom. I mean, this is a critical point to realize. In the demand letter that the Trump administration sent to my university Friday night that became public on Monday, one of his demands was to have the school appoint or allow him to appoint a federal overseer who would audit every course on this campus, every department, to try to figure out if it met the ideological balance that's preferred by the Trump administration. And that federal official would then require us to hire new teachers to teach the way that Trump wants us to teach, to change our courses. This is absolute outright efforts to take over federally what is taught on American campuses. It's a move that we see in countries across the globe when dictators are trying to come into power. We've seen it in Hungary, we've seen it in Russia. That is the exact move that the Trump administration is trying here right now.
I want to turn to, now Vice President J.D. Vance, but this was him speaking in 2021 at the National Conservatism Conference in Orlando, Florida.
I think if any of us want to do the things that we want to do for our country and for the people who live in it, we have to honestly and aggressively attack the universities in this country.
We have to attack the universities of this country. Professor Crespo, you have talked about Trump's demands and now Trump-Vance demands, saying that they're right out of the authoritarian's playbook. And you just talked about other countries in the world. Explain exactly what you mean and the many demands that the Trump administration has made of Harvard. Of course, it did it of Columbia, and you might have something interesting to say about Columbia caving to those demands, making demands of Northwestern, where Juan is in Chicago, what saying that they'll cut $750 million, Brown University, they'll cut $500 million. Explain exactly what they're demanding Harvard do.
Well, I think it's so critical that you played that clip from the now vice president from years ago, because I think it really makes clear what this is all about. You know, the Trump administration is asserting and claiming in these most recent threats that it is trying to purge these universities of anti-Semitism. Now, look, I am second to no one in making clear that anti-Semitism is something that is vile. I think of it as a form of racism and intolerance. But that is not what these investigations are about, as evidenced by the fact that J.D. Vance was talking about the universities as enemies years and years ago. This is an effort to try to take over the ideological agenda of the country by taking over universities. It's an effort, when I say a page out of the authoritarian playbook, I'm talking about what we learn from lessons of history and across the globe. When people come into power and try to control and hold on to power contra the norms of a constitutional democracy, they attack the critical institutions of a free and open society. They attack the press, they attack the courts, they attack the legal profession, and they attack universities. And that is exactly what we have seen this administration doing relentlessly over the first months of its second term. Why is it putting all that energy into this at the beginning of its term? Because it knows that those are the institutions where open and free inquiry, where dissent, where protest, where critical thinking, where questioning are not only prized but treated as the core value of the institution. This is a university, like so many others across the country, where diversity of viewpoints is celebrated, and not only celebrated but central to our mission. I teach at a law school. Every year, I stand up in front of hundreds of students and try to get them to lean into all the different ways in which they disagree with each other in productive and exciting ways. That's how new knowledge is formed. When you try to suppress that type of differences of opinion and impose your own ideological agenda on a university from the government, you're trying to suppress speech on a campus. And I think the reason to do that is because people know that open, free inquiry and free speech are some of the critical aspects of maintaining a democracy in the face of threats to it. So that's why I say it's a page out of that playbook. The demands that have been made of our university make that clear. This demand list goes so far beyond even anything remotely touching anti-Semitism. They're asking us to shutter all programs and offices related to DEI. Now look, we know from experience in Florida and when Ron DeSantis did the dry run of this with the universities there, that the administration uses DEI as a code word for saying they want us to stop teaching anything about race or the American history with respect to questions about our racial history. They want us to stop teaching questions about social inequality. They want us to stop researching about the impact and the different and disparate impacts of different policies on different groups of people. They want us to stop pursuing the truth when it touches on parts of our American truth that they don't want us to acknowledge or talk about or study or try to redress, because they have a political agenda and they know that universities don't, that universities are trying to pursue knowledge where we find it.
I wanted to ask you what your thoughts are of how other universities should be acting. Clearly, Harvard is in perhaps the best position with more than $50 billion endowment to be able to withstand these kinds of cuts and attacks. But higher education institutions around the country, especially even public universities, have already started to cave in to a lot of pressure from the Trump administration. What is your advice to these other institutions?
It's such a critical point. I mean, you are right. Harvard is the best positioned to take this stand. It's the most well-known and wealthiest university in the world, and that's why so many of us here, including our AAUP chapter, felt that we had a moral obligation to take this stand at the front of the line. But the hope is that we are not going to be doing this alone. There is no institution that by itself can stand up to the onslaught that is coming from the federal government right now. It's a dangerous onslaught, and the only way to resist it is, in fact, to stand together. That's why I think it's so important, and we're starting to see statements from other university presidents across the country, from other leaders throughout the sector, from former President Barack Obama, standing up in favor of higher education, explaining not just to the other members of this sector, to our other, you know, faculty colleagues at other schools, university leaders at other schools, but to the American people, just how critical higher education is, not just for the people on these campuses, but for the country. I mean, this is something we want to make sure everyone understands. These billions and billions of dollars that are being threatened come directly from science and medical research that is trying to solve and cure diseases, that is trying to invent the new technologies that will help us with climate change and other issues facing our country and our world. Everyone in the world benefits when the federal government partners with American research institutes to find these new solutions to the most challenging, you know, problems of our day. And everyone in this country benefits, going beyond scientific research, when we have universities that study American history so that we don't repeat the problems of our past and so we can understand where we come from and what our values are. When we have law schools that teach about the rule of law and how central it is to the ongoing existence of a constitutional democracy. When we teach literature and art and dance and poetry so we remember why it is that we flourish as human beings. These are essential aspects of a thriving society. If you try to kneecap your universities, you're kneecapping your country. You're kneecapping the people across the world who depend on your research and your discoveries. That's why this is so dangerous, and that's why this whole sector has to come together. I'm proud to be a chapter of a national organization, the American Association of University Professors, that has been leading the way with faculty members across the country taking initiative to file lawsuits, to organize on their campuses, and to try to build that network of solidarity across the profession and across the sector.
What do you think was the reason Harvard took this stance? I mean, the reason so many people were stunned is the stances it's taken before. I mean, first you have the ousting after a congressional hearing of Claudine Gay, the president. Then you have the ousting of the head of the Middle East Department. It was really seen as a beginning of a way to deal with the Trump administration. You yourself were banned from your own library for supporting pro-Palestinian students. But now, this enormous turnaround.
Well, I think there's potentially a couple of factors to it, Amy, although I don't know. I mean, I haven't been speaking with the leadership of the university directly and don't know their thinking on it. But I'm glad to see their actions. You know, the timeline here is when these threats happened, our chapter went into a real crisis mode, and we decided that we needed to file this lawsuit. And we had terrific help from wonderful law firms that rushed in to help us. And within a few days, we were in court. And we were filing our complaint on behalf of our chapter, on behalf of the professors here at Harvard who are harmed by this, and on behalf of our students.
I wanted to quickly ask you, I'm going to cut you off because I wanted to get to the law firms, and we just have a minute. A judge just ruled on behalf of Sussman Godfrey that the Trump administration's executive order against this law firm can't stand for the moment. We did an interview with Steve Sussman, more than a decade ago, amazing, pioneering lawyer who represented an indigenous community in Alaska against big oil because of climate change. But it's not just Sussman Godfrey. It's all of these law firms. You're a law professor. The significance of this attack on law firms.
The attacks on law firms are one of the most dangerous things we're seeing. Look, one of the key checks that we have seen so far in the early days of the Trump administration on these authoritarian power grabs have been actions in court. Now, the president keeps flirting with the idea of not obeying court orders, but so far, the courts have been holding, and you need lawyers to bring those cases in court. So instead of attacking the courts directly, what he's doing is attacking the lawyers. He's trying to intimidate the entire legal profession into standing down and leaving him a free, open path to do whatever it is that he wants. He understands that law can be a check on authoritarian moves. So he's trying to bankrupt these law firms. Now, every law firm that has gone to court so far has gotten a quick and strong order from a judge. judge protecting them from these executive orders. That should be a strong signal to every other law firm out there. What the Trump administration is trying to do with these attacks is unconstitutional. You are lawyers. You can go to court and you can file for that type of protection. And I hope that each time a law firm does that, it will breed more and more courage across the profession, because that's another sector that needs to stand united and stand tall in the face of these threats.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, and just add on Sussman Godfrey that they did represent Dominion Voting Systems. Andrew Manuel Crespo, Morris Wasserstein, Public Interest Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, General Counsel of the Harvard Faculty Chapter of the American Association of University Professors, which has filed a federal lawsuit.